This is the Mobile Arcade Club, a podcast about playing cool mobile games with friends, especially those featured on Apple Arcade. I'm Stephen, and he's Chris. This episode, Sneaky Sasquatch and Doomsday Vault.
Welcome, arcade friends, to episode 8 of the Mobile Arcade Club. This episode, we're talking about Sneaky Sasquatch and Doomsday Vault. But before we jump into that, got a couple of topics to discuss. The first one is that Apple started the new year of 2020 off by sharing a press release where they were talking about their services that they were working on throughout 2019, such as Apple TV Plus, Apple News Plus, all that sort of stuff, and of course Apple Arcade. And in this press release, they didn't release a lot of details about their plans for Apple Arcade for 2020. However, they did state that the service will continue to release new games and expansions each month throughout 2020. So that's nice, Stephen. They will continue to support that. So I think, you know, with not that we know how much money they've spent on it, you'd like to think they'd support it for the long haul.
It's interesting. It seems like they've got a lot lined up, and they seem to have this stuff lined up a lot ahead of time, because I've noticed with what was the game with the kings?
Kings of the Castle.
Kings of the Castle, yes. I noticed with that it had update notes from 5 years ago.
Or five months ago,
yeah, sorry. Yeah. And it seems as though that's been ready to go and is waiting for Apple's okay. So I assume there's probably a whole pile of games sitting hidden on the App Store at the moment, just waiting for their moment to burst out onto the store, onto the subscription service. So it's nice to know they've got, you know, at least the next year coming up. They're not just throwing this service out there and letting it languish, as has happened with some services, with, you know, Apple and others as well. But yeah, it's good to know we've got something to look forward to.
Yeah, I think one thing that's interesting about, and I agree with you, Stephen, about the games that are ready to go and they're in the system just waiting for Apple to hit the big red launch button.
I imagine they have a very big physical red launch button somewhere at Apple HQ.
Yes. I imagine, and it's only given to the most hallowed of employees to press.
Of course.
But this red button that may or may not exist, I think it's throughout 2019, or at least since the September launch of Apple Arcade, there was a bit of a not necessarily a clear schedule of release of games, because when it first launched, it seemed like there were games coming out weekly. Then there were some that came out every fortnight, or some were more of a drip feed throughout the case of a month. And perhaps the period between September 2019 and here in January 2020, perhaps they've had a look at the data and, you know, churned some of the analytics and figured out, okay, so if we want some of these games to perform at their best in terms of getting a decent amount of downloads and people playing them, then, you know, perhaps they've got a better idea of, you know, what release schedule works best for maybe certain types of games, or at least for this service.
Yeah, sort of what lets each one of them shine without, you know, if you release too many good games at the same time, only one of them is going to really be able to capture the, you know, the world's heart and attention, I guess. So, yeah, you'd have to take that into account, and there'd obviously be the business side of things as how many do we need to put out every, you know, month or so before people start cancelling their subscriptions because they're not getting enough video games to play for the money. There'll be some interesting business decisions to make there. And I think, to me, it kind of stands out as someone who follows Nintendo, and they have their own subscription service where they have what I feel should be some mountain of existing games for old consoles that they could bring at any point, and they sort of saying, oh, we'll have this many a month, and then it gradually goes down to nothing, and now they just kind of don't have a schedule anymore. They might just throw out three at once and then never touch it for a month or two. It's very nice to see that, you know, Apple being relatively new to taking gaming this seriously, let's say, they are doing a better job than some of the more established players in how subscriptions work, and, you know, actually giving you what you want for what you're paying a monthly fee for.
Yeah, well, as much as I love Nintendo, Nintendo will be Nintendo and play sort of much to the beat of their own drum. Apple seem to have a pretty good handle on things. And you sort of touched on, you know, the release schedule, trying to capture an audience to pay for this subscription without running out of games to play. I cannot believe the people who say, oh, there's just not enough content to keep me going and that sort of stuff. We're still trying to catch up on games that were there since the launch of Apple Arcade.
Honestly, yeah. Like, I do see it a lot on the subreddit, people saying, oh, I'm not sure if there's enough here for me to continue my subscription. And obviously it's going to be down to taste. If there's a specific kind of game you want to play and there's not a lot of that on there, then, you know, more power to you. You know your tastes better than anyone else will. But yeah, gosh, I feel as myself, I'm fairly open to lots of different kinds of experiences, especially in mobile, where they're getting all these interesting experiences. And gosh, yeah, there's more than I'm ever going to be able to play already, and it's just continuing. So I'm more than happy with what we're getting on there.
Yeah, and I think both of us were very, very happy with this first game that we're going to discuss. The first game that we'll discuss here on Episode 8 is Sneaky Sasquatch by RAC7 Games. Now, goodness, this was an absolute delight.
Yeah, gosh, where to start with this one? It's one that immediately stood out to me at the launch of Apple Arcade. It kind of looked like one of those things. This is going to be the thing that sells me on this service as a whole. This kind of game that you don't see on mobile very much, because it wouldn't be able to exist without a scummy monetization system otherwise. And I feel like this kind of game really relies on not making you, I don't know, come back every few hours, all the typical strategies that are often used to maintain engagement and stuff. This is just a really well-designed, really fun, full of personality, just a great fun game that you don't need to worry about how it's milking you at any point in time. I love it.
Yeah, so the concept is that you play, as the name of the game suggests, you play as a Sasquatch.
Yes.
And you play in this nice sort of campgrounds surrounds in
National parky sort of area.
National park, you know, this lush, you know, beautiful green foresty area. And essentially the aim of the game is to wander around these campgrounds, sneak around and steal food.
Sasquatch is going to get hungry. You need to eat some food. And I don't know, for whatever reason, you're a Sasquatch who doesn't hunt the local wildlife, I guess. You just have to eat the food of the people who have brought it there. You just go around to their, you know, Esky coolers and take some Coke, take some sausages, go to the fridge. It's very, very silly. And I think they lean super into that, which is delightful.
Yeah, and I think perhaps other than perhaps the fish that are foraged from ponds and the lake and that sort of stuff, perhaps the Sasquatch has a bit of an arrangement with the local wildlife in terms of, hey, you know, I like you, I think you're cool, I'm not going to eat you.
Yeah, he talks to, I don't know, I assume he, but maybe not, the Sasquatch can talk to a lot of the animals, so I guess, I don't know, maybe if you can have a conversation with an animal, you don't want to eat them anymore.
Yeah, well, I think perhaps, perhaps that's the arrangement. But I think the big thing here is the Sasquatch has a number of different arrangements with some of these animal companions, for lack of a better sort of phrase. But as well as needing to nourish your hunger as the Sasquatch to eat food from the campers and, you know, forage through rubbish bins and that sort of stuff. And so obviously you've got a meter, like sort of a circle, sort of, if you
like
think
a hunger pizza.
Yeah, a hunger pizza, yeah. I was sort of going to say like the health meter in Super Mario 64 or something like that. Yeah, you know, it sort of works its way through this circle. So you've got to forage enough food to make sure you fill up your hunger meter, which you can eat the food that you've foraged in your backpack, because you've got a backpack come rucksack sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you've got to, you know, sort of perch yourself on a nearby, you know, sort of picnic bench, and you dump out all of the contents of your backpack. And arguably one of the best parts of the game is you've got to sort of control these noodly arms to direct the food into your mouth, which the Sasquatch will very funnily go, nah, 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 nah.
Just the sounds and the visuals are just, they're kind of hilarious. Just, it just leaves all of these marks all over the face just because it's eating like a gremlin, I guess. It's very a Cookie Monster in how he eats.
Yeah, and doesn't really pay attention to packaging either.
No,
so
just,
you pick up a random half consumed bottle of ketchup and No, you're just you're not squirting the ketchup into your mouth. You're just eating the bottle, and obviously this Sasquatch has got some pretty good chompers.
Yeah,
some
good chompers, teeth. And clearly some good digestive organs to deal with all the plastic they're eating.
Yeah, but in addition to the hunger meter, there's also a bit of a wildlife economy, so to speak. There's a very friendly grizzly bear. I'm not sure about my bear variants, but I'm assuming this is like a grizzly bear who lives nearby. And they will happily pay the Sasquatch in coins. How it's accumulated this wealth, I'm not sure.
Mystery.
Yeah, but this bear will very happily pay for any leftover food at the end of the day that this Sasquatch has accumulated, and very, very endearingly refers to you as Sam Squanch.
Sam Squanch. It's a very interesting way in, you know, both that it's a really neat character, but in the way that it adds a new system into the game. You sort of start playing and I'm thinking, okay, I've just got to go forage enough food, come back and just do that over and over. Mm. And then, if you've got any food left over, you can sell it to the bear. And then if you happen to have enough money, then there's a friendly raccoon who lives nearby who operates a store. He's very, he reminded me a little bit of Tom Nook in Animal Crossing, just in the way as a shrewd businessman. And you can buy all of these items, which completely change the things you can do in the game. Things like a shovel to dig up treasure, or a set of human clothes so that you can live amongst the humans undetected. It just opens up way more than I ever expected it to, and for that reason it sort of has a lot longer legs than I thought it would.
Yeah, and the fact that it actually has so many different gameplay elements to it as well, in terms of you can buy a fishing pole and then fish in the pond or the lake, or you can buy an oar so you can go rowing in a boat or canoe or whatever it is. You can also purchase the keys to a golf cart, so you've got some motorized method of transport, which that creates for its own sense of fun and hilarity, as pretty well everything in this game does, with how charmingly and caringly crafted it is. I suppose that there's not heaps in the way of challenge as such, but that the main challenge is that even if, say, down the track in Sneaky Sasquatch, you purchase these human clothes, which for some reason people are then unable to see your face covered in fur.
You just look like a heavily bearded person.
perhaps, the Sasquatch looks like one of us then.
Maybe.
But The thing is that the local park rangers will be able to see through any disguise, or if you're not wearing the disguise, then people will sort of, gain an alert meter that fills up. It's sort of like a, Metal Gear Sasquatch.
Yes, you can hide in the bushes and escape their view. They'll hear you if you're walking too close to them. I think you can sneak around. I didn't make a lot of use of that, but I found that if you tap the screen, you'll sneak around as opposed to running around and sort of maintaining. Because it'll ask you to do a lot of little challengey things, I guess, which is some of the stuff that gets introduced beyond the getting enough food to survive element, is you'll have little challenges that reminded me a lot of Untitled Goose Game, a way to, it'll tell you you need to, annoy this man by pushing all of his canoes out into the river. But if he sees you, then he's, going to alert the park rangers, and you got to be sneaky about it, as a sneaky Sasquatch ought to be. It was just very fun. Just doing all these, just being a bothersome animal is very, very fun.
And what I liked is that when you've caused some of this, I won't go as far to say chaos, but it's sort of harmless, or sort of what's the word I'm thinking? Wholesome chaos.
Sure.
In terms of you're not doing any great harm to anyone, except for making it necessary for people to purchase more food. But the great thing is if you do manage to stuff up and a park ranger catches you, they'll sort of escort you back to your home area and sort of give you a stern talking to and say, hey, you can't do this, you'll scare the people. But they don't actually, you don't lose any of the food that you've accumulated. So you're not too heavily penalized, other than losing some time out of sort of the day-night cycle that takes place. So I think that also creates a great sort of sandbox environment for younger players.
Yes.
In that you know, younger players, or if you've got family members who want to play, or people who don't necessarily play a lot of games, that you can very safely hand them this game or play this game with them, and there's very few consequences for failure. Or
It's very low stakes.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's certainly very very good part of the game. And you mentioned Untitled Goose Game, and this was something that we were discussing a fair bit before recording, is that these two games came out very, very close to one another, and there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, it's interesting. This came out before Untitled Goose Game, but obviously it's hard to tell. We're never going to know if one influenced the other or if they just happened to be both pursuing similar-ish ideas at the same time. But yeah, it was very interesting to see those parallels, because when I very first played this game, I hadn't played Goose Game because it wasn't out yet. And then I played a bit of Goose, came back to this and go, that's interesting that they're both, you know, they're different enough that they don't feel like the same game. Like, this has much more than just, you know, the checklist of objectives. You've got, you know, all the different modes of play, the different ways of getting around, and the fact that, you know, doing an annoying thing to a village, a person around, is not the main objective at any point. It's just like a little optional extra. But yeah, it was very interesting how they both pursued that same idea from, you know, whether it's the main focus or just a little side thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And we, as an aside to that, we both enjoy consuming the media of one Kotaku's Tim Rogers. And recently he released a series of videos, including Games of the Decade and also Games of 2019. And in, I believe it was the Games of 2019 video, he discussed for a little bit Untitled Goose Game and mentioned, you know, why it was such a lovely game. And I'm definitely a fan of Untitled Goose Game.
100%.
I don't think I've actually come across someone who actively doesn't like that game. In fact, if you don't like Untitled Goose Game, I would hazard that you have no soul. But that's a discussion for another time.
This is an opinion endorsed only by Chris and not myself.
Well, I've been left hung out to dry then. The point that Tim Rogers made that I found quite interesting is that because of the overwhelming popularity of Untitled Goose Game, in terms of the way it's infiltrated not only just people who play games, but also popular press, and even there's, you know, been protests around, you know, political protests in Australia, in the UK, and, you know, elsewhere, where there are references to Untitled Goose Game.
Yeah, sort of, you know, gone into mainstream culture, I guess, mainstream pop culture at very least. It's sort of become a recognisable icon, even if you're not someone who's following the Melbourne indie game development scene. It's just everywhere.
Yeah, which is phenomenal. But with Untitled Goose Game, because of that popularity, Tim Rogers was wary of the fact that this will create a subgenre in itself of sort of, I think I paraphrased it in terms of the genre of animals being bad to humans.
Just being a bothersome animal sort of genre.
Yes, and he actually mentioned in his video, he quickly scrolled through one of the app stores or the Play Store, whatever it was, and showed how many cheap clone knockoffs of Untitled Goose Game there are already on mobile. And likely there's similar on Steam as well, considering how cluttered that marketplace is.
Yes.
But the big takeaway from that, especially since playing Sneaky Sasquatch, is that it's so easy to recommend Sneaky Sasquatch to someone who's looking for something to scratch the similar itch of Untitled Goose Game, because it is such a well-made game. It's got enough of its own individuality and personality and separate game elements as well that it's different enough to Untitled Goose Game, but still catches some of the same goofy fun.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't feel like it is taking anything from Untitled Goose Game. It just feels like maybe it came from similar ideas of you know, where they started from, but it's ended up in a totally different place. But you can just tell that there are similar elements and you can enjoy it for similar reasons.
Absolutely. And I think there's while in Untitled Goose Game there's a certain joy in having a dedicated honk button and being able to honk at will and scare people with, you know, sneaking up on them and honking. But in Sneaky Sasquatch, you play as a Sasquatch who can drive a golf cart.
And that's something in of its own.
Right? That's another joy in its own stratosphere. So yes. there's definitely similarities, and sort of, you know, to touch on that sort of Tim Rogers quote genre of animals doing bad things to humans. You know, Sneaky Sasquatch still retains that, you know, wholesomeness, and it's not it's not, you know, actively being nasty or that sort of thing. It's it's really, really worth sussing out if you know at all enjoyed Untitled Goose Game.
Yes, yeah, 100% agree on that.
So yeah, so that's an easy recommend for us. Sneaky Sasquatch by RAC7 Games. I believe, are they Canadian? I can't remember. Ooh, off the top
gosh,
of my head.
I wish I'd look into that.
Oh,
now.
That's all right.
Maybe. I know the park ranger reminded me of, I don't know, it felt a little bit Canadian. I don't know why. I might be wrong, but...
Yeah, I think even sort of the parklands, sort of the national park setting did feel sort of Canadian. More so Canadian than North American, I felt. But that's all right. We can always, make a note in the show notes if we've got that horribly wrong.
If we were wrong, we'll let you know.
Yes, if we were right, then we'll just silently take that in our pride. But of course, the next one, definitely not Canadian. This one was made in New Zealand by a studio known as Flightless. The game is known as Doomsday Vault, and it's very interesting. This one, when I first played this one, the cold open before the menu launches is very, very similar to Flightless's previous game Element, which I touched on briefly on the last episode, which is a minimal real-time strategy. But that one focused on sort of an Earth society that has had diminished and wasted its resources and was on the lookout for more resources on other planets, on the path to exploring another universe. Here, Flightless has explored similar themes with Doomsday Vault, except the Earth's resources have pretty well dried up. It's a bit of a wasteland.
Yeah.
However, you play as this little robot being, and you're tasked with finding the remaining plant life and storing and nurturing it in a vault.
It reminded me a little bit of sort of WALL-E, like that first moment of that, where it's just sort of wandering around this destroyed Earth, cleaning up and nurturing that little plant. It's very... I know it definitely gave me vibes of that, and that's a very good thing in my book.
Yeah, and I saw that you've made notes here about it's a very timely, it's a very current game, yes. And arguably these sort of games have been current for quite some time.
Yes,
far more years than perhaps some of us realise.
We've all grown up with Captain Planet, or at least people of my generation and probably yours. It's not a new thing, you know, concern for environmental preservation, but... It has become a quite sharply relevant thing in as of late, let's say. So it's it was a very interesting way. The fact that you're tasked with preserving what remains of the plant life on planet Earth and trying to bring back what has potentially been lost was, I'm not going to say confronting, like thematically it is, but the game doesn't sort of beat you over the head with it or anything, but it's definitely, timely and sort of relevant to the age that we're living in at the moment.
Indeed. And as for how Doomsday Vault approaches this, it's sort of in these little levels in different settings of Earth. So the first area is sort of like, how would you say, sort of like flooded?
Yeah, I think it's called Flooded City or something to that effect. And then, later on there's I think it's more of a deserty area from memory, and there was a third area that I didn't end up getting to, but I think that was a spaceport, maybe. But, all of these areas will have, it sort of plays on from an isometric view and in sort of a grid-based movement system. And I found that really, really useful because sometimes in games, especially on mobile, if I'm playing it with a touchscreen, sometimes having restrictions to the way in which you can move can make it easier to actually play. I guess full 3D movement, when we were doing that on consoles, we built entirely new controllers to accommodate how difficult that is to do with, four cardinal directions. And on mobile, with virtual sticks and stuff, it can be a little bit iffy sometimes. Mm. But yeah, I found this, it took me a couple of minutes to really acclimate to how you move around. I sort of was pushing in certain directions and it didn't really do what I expected for the first minute or so. But once it clicked in my brain, I love the way this game works. You can tap anywhere on the screens, drag in a particular direction and you will head that direction. And the game gives you a lot of, I guess, visual affordances of what you can do in the game. It'll have the little dots in each of the grid squares that you can move to, including ones vertically, which indicate surfaces that you can actually climb up without necessarily needing, a set of stairs or a ladder or something like that. And that, I found, took away some of the friction I've sometimes found in isometrically based games where, can I climb this? Can I not? You just kind of have to try it and trial and error, really. Whereas this took away some of that friction. It makes it a little bit more gamey looking, but I think it's for the best. It communicated what you can do in a really smart way, and I found that well worth the sacrifice of, realism or whatever you might want to call it.
Well, I think that also feeds into the creative direction of Doomsday Vault as well, in terms of it doesn't depict itself as a hyper-real, realistic sort of experience. As you were touching on just before we were recording, that a lot of big video games these days have almost a sort of an unwritten visual language that is often followed to indicate, oh, yes, you can explore this area, or you can climb this object, or this cliff face is scalable, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, sort of this is shimmering, this is a different color, something unnatural to indicate in... They try and make it unobtrusive, but sometimes in doing so it looks so out of place. But yeah, it's exactly what you're talking about.
Or even sometimes they've done such a good job of making it a seamless part of the game's world that if someone without that understanding of that, this sort of game genre or sort of generation's visual language, then perhaps it could be quite difficult to navigate. Or someone trying to get into a new game style or series or whatever may not realize, oh, hang on, I can actually climb this.
Yes.
Whereas, as you've touched on here with Doomsday Vault, because it is so clearly marked with the little dots, part of the user interface, and the way that you can sort of view this isometric little world, that it is very clear, okay, yes, I can move here. Or, because sometimes there are sort of, I found that there were sometimes objects or boxes that I thought I could climb in Doomsday Vault, but I couldn't. But the good thing is I didn't spend more time than necessary trying to climb it, because it didn't have that visual indicator to suggest, yes, you can climb this. Whereas if there was something else with some grips on it, as you say, like a vertical sort of terrain, that you could immediately identify, oh, this has got the dots on it, or this has got some of that universal interface.
This is a climbable surface sort of.
Yeah, because a lot of Doomsday Vault relies on sort of the navigation of this grid that's set up, and also moving and manipulating boxes and objects and other interactive things that you quite often have to move around in this space. So it's quite good that once you've got through those opening few minutes and sort of acclimatized to the game's sort of visual language and the way that it presents information, what you can and can't do, then more often than not, it's quite clear, how you can approach something, which I think is quite good.
And I quite like the way each of the levels is designed in a way that you can make it as challenging or not challenging as you really choose to. The only thing you need to do is your objective in the level is to find the seed of a plant that you're trying to save, and that lets you bring it back to the vault, and there you go. But as along the way, there will be extra sort of nutrient, either little vials of it or boxes, and just various scattered around the place, and some will be just hidden behind objects, so you kind of need to explore around. But a lot of them will be behind their own little, I guess, extra puzzle, for want of a better word. It's sort of, you'll need to manipulate the environment to allow yourself access to these little areas, and it will reward you in having more nutrients that you can later on use to create more crops of the plant that you find in that level. But yeah, the fact that it's entirely optional means you don't, if there's a particular puzzle that you just can't quite work out, or you just don't really feel like it at the time, then there's nothing to stop you just going straight to the end, grabbing whatever you happen to see on the way, and you're not going to feel like you're getting a worse version of the level by doing that. It's really approachable in that way.
Yeah, which is quite nice, because it does lend to some sort of customization of your experience, which I'm a big fan of games that do that, because if something's a little bit, a little bit difficult to try and figure out, that then you can sort of, move on. However, there was one aspect which, doesn't sort of feed into that same ethos as such, in terms of if you approach a level that you just don't quite get, you can't actually move on to the next level till you finish the previous one.
Yes, I did find that. I pretty well was playing it almost all in one. I think I played it in two sessions. What I did a whole pile of it once, and then had to stop, and then did a whole pile of it after. And the only reason I stopped in the second session was I got to what felt like the end of a level, but there was no plant there, so clearly I'd missed something. Sort of looked around, I couldn't work out what I was doing, so I thought, okay, I'll quit out of this level and maybe just go on to the next one, see how I go there and come back to this. And as you say, that's not an option. It's it lets you customize your difficulty and how many of the nutrients you choose to go after. But yeah, if you can't find that one objective, you can't move forward, which I find, I know it's yeah, as he says, a little bit against the ethos that's everywhere else in this game. It seems to allow you to approach it however you want to, unless you can't find the plant in a level, in which case you'd better go look for a guide, I guess.
Yeah, but I think as opposed to one of the games that we were discussing last year down in Bermuda, where it perhaps made a little bit more sense to be able to progress without doing all of the objectives. I think here in Doomsday Vault, it perhaps makes a little bit more sense, because the main objective is that, yeah, you are trying to preserve this plant life, and that is your sole mission, and anything else to that is periphery. So it probably does make sense that you can't move on. You can't say, oh, well, I give up trying to find that seed. I'll just find the next one. Because then it feeds into the next part of Doomsday Vault, which is more of a, I've found more of a nice cosmetic sort of aspect of the game. I haven't played enough to really see whether it plays a more tangible role later. But you're able to then spend some time in the vault once you've completed a level and collected the seed for that level. So I think the first couple of levels you recover the last seedlings for coconuts and bananas. So that when you go back to the vault, depending on how many nutrients you've accumulated along the way, you can also, you're able to plant the seedling, but depending on how many nutrients that you've collected, you can plant more of them at once. And then when you go back and play, or when you go and play another level and then come back to the vault, the nutrients will
sort of regenerate.
Yeah, will regenerate up to the maximum of what you collected for that particular level. So you can go back and see that your coconut trees have grown nice and tall, and then you can plant some more so they start from the start again while the others continue to grow and that sort of thing. And yeah, it's quite nice.
There's something innately satisfying about it, in that you just, things happen while you're not there, which I guess is a cornerstone of a lot of mobile games, but this doesn't feel like it's, gating your progress through any arbitrary means. It's just, you can come back later and you'll be able to plant more coconut trees, more banana trees. And it just, I know it's satisfying watching things build and grow over time, and you can make that happen faster if you choose to go and seek out all of the nutrients. But even if you don't, you can still, at a slower rate, just have things, I know, watching things grow, it's satisfying. It's, I don't know, I've grown a basil plant this year and it's been very satisfying, and it gets me in a similar way to this game, I guess. It's nice to see something that you've put effort into, whether it's in a video game or in real life, and to see some sort of ongoing flow result from that is just a nice feeling.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier about not knowing whether there's a tangible result or impact on the game experience as a result of planting these various seedlings. But as opposed to games like, Harvest Moon or Stardew Valley, which rely on an in-game economy to sell produce, I think I think the overall themes of Doomsday Vault and the fact that it's, you know, so thematically leaning on preservation of these plants and various plant life is that I think it's reward in itself, just sort of feeling like in this game, oh yeah, I've, you know, helped save a plant and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I did this, and so, you know, the cacao plant exists as a result of my actions, and that's just satisfying in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think that would be. And I think that would be entirely intentional from the Flightless team in terms of when you've saved, you know, the last remaining species of a particular strain of plant, I think you don't need any further reward than that.
Yes, yeah, money's kind of meaningless after that.
Yeah, especially considering you don't actually, from what I've played, I haven't seen any human life or any form of economy. So I haven't
seen any other form of life, really. Not even, I don't think I've encountered any other robots or anything like that. Yeah. You're sort of the only moving, self-aware creature in the whole place. So that might change at the end of the game. I'm about, you know, 60% through. But it is an interesting way of exploring the world and just you being the only sentient being there.
And I think the puzzles and the approach to progressing through these levels in Doomsday Vault is there's some challenge to it. I wouldn't say there's a lot of challenge, but I'd say this is good for someone who may be sort of more of a beginner or not as experienced with some of these sort of puzzle games. But I think beyond that, it's also a worthwhile experience for those who, which hopefully is many, who are very invested in what's currently going on globally as far as our climate and our ecosystems.
Yeah, I think sort of mechanically I found it, I am experienced with this kind of puzzle game, but I often find if they're more complex than a certain point, it'll be enough to kind of turn me off the game. And this was a nice, calm level of puzzling where I felt like I had to think a little bit, but not so much that I'm going to bed with a headache. It was a nice, it was just very pleasant to play through.
Yeah, definitely. So that's Doomsday Vault from Flightless down in New Zealand. So that brings us to the end of this episode of the Mobile Arcade Club, which of course means that we'll announce what we're playing over the next fortnight. So,
indeed, I'd like you to announce the first one because you have to say the name of the developer and I don't know that I could trust myself to do so.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I trust myself with the name of the game either, but the first game that we'll be sussing out on episode 9 is Mutazione.
We'll work it out between now and next episode.
But one thing I'm a little bit more confident in saying is that it's developed by Die Gute Fabrik, a German studio, which I believe Die Gute Fabrik means... What is it?
Is that the Good Factory?
Yeah, the Good Factory. That's right. Yes. But the tagline for Mutazione is an interesting one. A mutant soap opera where small town gossip meets the supernatural.
It's got me hooked.
Yeah, it's very much a narrative-based one from what I've read, so that always excites me. And we're going for something a little bit different for the next game, Kings of the Castle, which has, at the time of recording, has only recently released in the last few days.
Yeah, gosh, I got the notification about it on my phone just earlier this week, I think. Yeah, it's a new one from Frosty Pop, who have... featured on the podcast before through the Pinball Wizard, which we both were quite fans of.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, this one, it refers to itself as Speed to the Rescue as its tagline. It looks sort of like a first-person racing platform game of sorts, but also it has multiplayer elements as well. I don't quite know what to expect from it. I watched a lot of the videos on the App Store and I'm still, I wonder how this game plays or, you know, what's going to be the ultimate... objective of the game, but yeah, very keen to see how this works out.
Yeah, one thing's for sure, it certainly looks very pretty, so yes. we'll definitely give you the lowdown come next fortnight.
Absolutely.
And thank you once again for joining us on the Mobile Arcade Club, and see you next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Mobile Arcade Club. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps us out heaps. You can follow the show on Twitter at MArcade Club,
There you can share any thoughts or feedback you have about the show, as well as chat about the club games, or maybe even games you'd like to share with the show. You can follow Chris and myself too if you'd like. Our handles are in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time.